Good morning. We have developed the tradition here of taking this occasion to remark on people who retire from our community, and I want to do that today for two distinguished colleagues. First, let me mention Earl Dudley. Earl joined the faculty in 1989. It's not unusual for law professors to have had some practice experience before they enter teaching. Earl had an entire career before he entered teaching. He graduated from the law school in 1967, having been editor-in-chief of the Law Review and having won the Woods Prize for the outstanding graduating student. He immediately went to the Supreme Court nominally to clerk for retired Justice Stanley Reed, but actually he worked for the Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren. After a year with the Chief Justice, Earl went to Wilmer Cutler and then to Williams Connolly, where he became an extremely skilled litigator. In 1975, he left Williams Connolly to become the general counsel to the House Committee on the Judiciary under Congressman Rodino. After a couple of years in the government, he went back to private practice, first with the firm of Seymour and Dudley, and then with the firm of Nussbaum, Owen, and Webster. And during that time also served as deputy independent counsel in a major investigation. Now, the phenomenon of a senior lawyer with vast experience in the private practice and in government service coming into law teaching used to be common, but today it is rare. And in itself, perhaps that's not really surprising. Like every other field of endeavor, law seems increasingly to become a collection of specialties. I guess that's because simply of the increasing complexity of what we all study and do. But whatever the reason, various specialties within the legal profession have become more separate and distinct, and that includes academic law. Earl Dudley may be the last of the great generalists. He may well be the last exemplar of a long tradition of lawyers who came into teaching after a full career's worth of accomplishment elsewhere. That's all the more reason to celebrate Earl today and his achievements, but it's also perhaps a reason to pause and reflect on the value of that tradition and on what it provided to generations of law students. The key point, as I see it, is that what Earl Dudley did here in his second career benefited enormously from and derived directly from his first career in private practice. First, Earl showed the colors of a true generalist and what he taught, which was practically everything. His staples were evidence and constitutional law, but he also taught civil procedure and criminal law too, trial advocacy, a principles and practice seminar on the prosecution function, seminars and ethical values, a seminar on leading lives in the law, and another on the American jury system. All of these offerings, whether courses or seminars, were informed by Earl's vast experience as a lawyer, so that he wasn't merely teaching our students subjects of importance to the law, he was teaching them how to be lawyers. Earl captured in his person and in his classroom the long arc between the intellectual discipline that is the foundation of the law and the cultural, social, political, and institutional context in which the lawyer's intelligence and learning are brought to bear. Put simply, his teaching was informed in ways that the teaching of most of us could not be. And my goodness, how our students responded. They took Earl to heart. They respected him. They admired him. They talked to him, as they really do not talk that much to some of us. They sought his advice on every conceivable subject, advice which I believe he bestowed with characteristic generosity. And in the end, they loved him. And with his friend George Rutherglen, with whom Earl had a number of scholarly collaborations, Earl taught a seminar on leading lives in the law. The readings for that seminar were biographies of great lawyers, and the lessons for discussion were lessons in legal ethics. Legal ethics, not in the narrow sense of the code of professional responsibility, which is pretty much a list of thou shalt nots for the practice of law. But legal ethics in the broader sense, indeed the broadest sense, of the ethical responsibilities of the lawyer as citizen. And this seminar proved so successful that we now have a whole program modeled after that example, the seminars in ethical values. No one contends, Earl would not, I would not, that merely talking with our students about ethical choices and responsibilities makes them proof against temptations to later misconduct. But it does help make sure that ethical traps don't catch them unawares, that they're not caught by surprise by the ethical dimensions of what they do. And every such conversation helps reiterate the important message that we in this institution care about integrity. Earl exemplified that commitment. He personified it for our students. In these and many other ways, there is continuity between Earl's first career and second. And that word continuity is my excuse and the only foundation for telling essentially an unrelated story. Earl and his family were in the Philippines at the time of Pearl Harbor, and within minutes of that attack, Japanese planes also attacked the Philippines, seriously injuring Earl, then aged 1 year, and his mother. Earl's leg was shattered. More critically, he stopped breathing. Oxygen was tried. Mouth-to-mouth resuscitation was tried. They failed. And the doctor on the scene was prepared to move on and to say that the cause was hopeless. When an Army nurse, remembering that whiskey is sometimes an effective stimulant, took a piece of gauze, soaked it in whiskey, and put it in the boy's mouth. And then in the words of the official history written by an Army nurse, at first the baby did nothing. Then slowly he started to suck. Harder and harder, until at last blue gave way to pink, to white, white to pink, and pink to crying. Earl, I suppose that in the Philippines on December 8th, as it then was in 1941, that it is not reasonable to believe that that whiskey was bourbon. But I like to believe that nonetheless, as it documents a taste that you and I share and that I hope we will have occasion to share many, many times in the future, and that explains what might otherwise be thought inappropriate.
Thank you very much, John. I have often wondered whether that was the origin of my lifelong friendship with bourbon. When I entered law school here in the fall of 1964, I am sure I had to be the despair of my mother-in-law. Here I had been married to her daughter for only three years, and I was already embarking on my third potential career. She was kind enough never to say so in my presence, but she had to think I was the ultimate ne'er-do-well. If only the poor lady knew. After a very unhappy and disillusioning year in academic graduate school, and two happier but ultimately unsatisfying years as a newsman, truth be told, was not very enthusiastic about law school. I was pretty sure I wanted a law degree, but I was not at all sure about a legal education. I'd gone to college in New England, and most of my friends who had gone on to law school had attended Harvard, and not one of them had a good word to say about the experience. So I arrived in Charlottesville expecting the worst. Prepared to put my head down, grit my teeth, work hard for 3 years, get a degree, and get out. I particularly recall resenting being required to take not just one course, but as we did it in those days, two whole semesters of property law. I might not have known what I wanted to be, but I was quite sure that I was never going to be a conveyancer of real estate. So why did I have to waste so much of my time studying that dry and dusty old stuff? I, of course, attended Dean Dillard's introductory remarks, his famous welcome to the last of the learned professions speech, and I was intrigued by it, but I remained resolutely skeptical, and I kept my eye firmly fixed on that damn property course. So imagine my surprise and delight when I realized, after less than 2 weeks after classes had begun, that I was having more fun, that I was more intellectually engaged than I had ever been. And for me, that was a considerable statement because I had had a wonderful undergraduate experience. And imagine my further surprise to discover that property, as taught by Tom Bergen, was perhaps my favorite course, certainly in my top two. This sense of fascination, this engagement with the law, has never left me. I found my intellectual home, and I never strayed. Indeed, I ultimately joined the swollen ranks of those who view their 3 years here as a student as among the best 3 years of their life. I'm enormously grateful to this wonderful institution. It afforded me an outstanding legal education, and which provided, as John mentioned, really the foundation for two rather different careers. And for the last 19 years has provided me with the only job I've ever been able to hold for any length of time. It's a source of some considerable satisfaction and not a little pride to me to be able to say that I have been associated with the law school now for 44 years. The law school has given me countless benefits, countless friendships among my schoolmates, my teachers, my fellow alumni, my colleagues, and my students that have enriched my life beyond measure. I'm proud to have known the last seven deans of the law school and to have served under four of them. One of the great pleasures in returning here in 1989 to teach was that eight, I believe, of my teachers were still on the faculty at that time, and I had the honor to become their colleague. Two of them, Peter Lowe and Dick Howard, will outlast me. As I said to Dick earlier this morning, there may be some question whether Dick will outlast the law school. The challenge of the classroom, the engagement of scholarship, the real pleasure of working with my colleagues, and the fascination of my many forays into university administration have all made my life here a rich and full one indeed. But no professional pleasure can match what my students have given me. The joy of knowing them, working with them, watching them grow as lawyers and blossom as people, staying in touch with them, following their careers, meeting their spouses and significant others and their children, I know that I have gained far more from them than they could ever possibly have learned from me. So in so many ways, I feel truly blessed. By leaving now, I am achieving a goal that I have harbored all my adult life, which is to retire while I still love my job. Indeed, I wouldn't leave now were it not for the fact that there are so many other things I want to do before I die that this work stuff is beginning to get seriously in the way. So I leave looking forward, not backward, forward to an exciting new phase of my life. And it is with the same sense of excitement and confidence that I look forward to the future of the law school. If I have a regret, it is that I will not have the opportunity, the pleasure, to serve under our new dean, whom I have known as a friend and a colleague and admired for 18 years. Paul Mahoney is one of the outstanding scholars of his time and field, and he is a powerful teacher. His leadership qualities are evident, and his vision for the law school is inspiring. Most important, Paul understands, is imbued with, and will continue to foster the unique ethos that sets this place apart from, and in my view, above all others. Civility in disagreement, genuine caring and mutual supportiveness, dedication to teaching and the nurturing of our students, and integrity in all things related to the law. This is a time of considerable generational changeover on the faculty. And as good as we old guys think we have been, and who knows, maybe we were, that's not at all a bad thing. With Paul's leadership, with the strength of the younger faculty recruited by his predecessors, and with the support of all of you, I am confident that the law school will scale the heights he envisions for it. And I want to say thanks to John for his wonderful leadership of the law school over these last 8 years, and for his friendship and support ever since I have been here. I thank all of you and so many more from the bottom of my heart for a really wonderful time.
Thank you, Earl. The other faculty member whom we lose to retirement this year is Glenn Robinson. Let me tell you a little bit about him. Glenn was born in 1936 in Utah, graduated from the Harvard Law School in 1958. I'm sorry, from Harvard University as an undergraduate in 1958, from Stanford Law School in 1961. He was in private practice with Covington and Burling through most of the 1960s, and her teaching at the University of Minnesota in 1967. Left in 74 to be commissioner of the FCC for 2 years, from 74 to 76. And on leaving the FCC, he came to Virginia, where he has been for now 32 years, save for a time when he was away from us to serve as United States ambassador and head of the United States delegation to the World Administrative Radio Conference in 1979. In 2003, Glenn was appointed one of the inaugural David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professorships, which is the highest honor this institution can bestow. Several years ago, my colleague Dan Ortiz said of Glenn, I'm quoting, "It's not just that he's still enthusiastic, but that he's still coming up with new ideas. It's seldom you find that kind of continuing enthusiasm from someone," this Dan is a good deal younger than we, "seldom that you find that kind of continuing enthusiasm from someone who has been in any kind of work for a long time. He's a model for us all." Those words were true when uttered, and they are true today on the eve of Glenn's retirement from active teaching. To law faculty at Virginia and to law faculty across the nation, Glenn is a model for us all. And to understand why that's true, you have to know something about the extraordinary range and comprehensiveness of his intellectual interest. Let me give you a high-speed tour. Glenn has written about communications law, about the electronic First Amendment, about spectrum property law, about the Telecommunications Act of 1996, about cable television and the First Amendment, and a whole series of books and articles on the Federal Communications Commission. Glenn's scholarship on communications law, standing alone, would make a very respectable academic career. But he's also written a lot on administrative law generally. He has a leading casebook in that field and has written articles on public choice theory and the American bureaucracy, on independent agencies. He's written on the line item veto on a theory of legislative delegation. He's written on administrative rulemaking, on the making of administrative policy, even on the Forest Service. He is one of the foremost administrative law experts in the country. He has also written often and well on torts, including articles on the valuation of mass tort claims and on probabilistic causation and compensation for risk, multiple causation in tort law, and again, a whole series of articles on medical malpractice. But wait, there's more. He's also written on antitrust, I'm going to spare you those, and on property, and articles on property, and some articles like a perfectly wonderful 1997 piece in the Virginia Law Review entitled Communities, that are simply impossible to pigeonhole. Now, I haven't mentioned all of Glenn's scholarship, but my point isn't numbers, it's breadth. Glenn Robinson's intellectual interests range across the legal landscape. His curiosity leads him to focus on puzzles in the law, puzzles that sometimes lie within one particular field, but that often do not. Often they bridge the curricular categories, torts, property, and the like, that define and confine the way we think about law. Puzzles that sometimes reach all the way back to the background conventions that frame the way we think about law. Glenn's curiosity is an offshoot of intelligence, of course, but it's also an offshoot of our product of intellectual imagination, the peculiar ability to see problems in ways that are completely new and unanticipated. It's wonderful and rare, that ability. Wonderful and rare in any person, and I think I have the standing to say this, especially in a person of mature years. Once the bloom of youth is past, academics tend to work within familiar paradigms. We tend to exploit mostly familiar methodologies. Many of us are drawing down on a lifetime of investment in intellectual capital, but perhaps not making too many new deposits. Glenn Robinson is a magnificent exception. Over the long arc of his career, he has never stood still. He is exemplary not only in his continuing scholarly activity, but also in his continuing intellectual ambition. He has learned new subjects, he has written about new technologies, and his intellectual style is evident not only in the range of subjects he addresses, but also in the terms of his analysis. This to me is critical. Glenn does not begin with prior commitments. He does not start from a fixed point of view or from some political or ideological commitment that he aims to prove over and over again. He begins instead with the puzzle, with the question, with the odd fact or the incomplete theory that requires some additional explanation. And Glenn's explanations aren't prepackaged or pat. They come from the facts and the law that Glenn is trying to interpret. His is a wide-ranging intellect and also a free-spirited one. He has, in fact, the kind of mind and intellectual personality that every academic admires. Glenn, I said this to you once before on a different occasion. I repeat it now in front of this audience. You are who we want to be when we grow up. That is the way your colleagues feel about you. Glenn Robinson, in fact, a model for us all. Glenn?
Now, this is a smaller model, but better stuff.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, John. Wow. After all that, I better be quick and probably would be best to just sit down. One way of characterizing all this activity that John spoke of is to simply say I have a kind of a wandering mind in a short time span, short attention span. I came here 32, just shy of 32 years ago. I haven't been here as long as Earl. I came here not exactly as a callow youth. Well, callow I probably was. I wasn't all that youthful. Which is to say, as John reported, that I had been in private practice for several years. I had been teaching for several years. I'd been in government for a couple of years. So I sort of thought I knew something. When I came here, I realized just how little I knew. When I came here, the top university law schools, top law schools across the country were diversifying their intellectual portfolio, getting into interdisciplinary studies. And Virginia was a leader. It's always been a leader in that endeavor. And it was quite thrilling. I mean, it was really quite exciting to be a part of that movement, getting in sort of in the early phase of it. It was also very daunting. I had not been really trained for that kind of work. I had what you could only call a basic black dress liberal arts education. You know, you get a little Plato and a little poetry and a little political science and a lot of Russian novels. And that was my education. I went to law school. I got basic black letter training there at Stanford in those days. The curriculum was pretty much fixed. Earl, if you thought it was tough taking a full semester of property, we had 2 years of property. We pored over the rule against perpetuities. Oh, my God. I never learned it until I started trying to teach it. But it was not a cutting-edge education. I'm sorry to report it could have been a lot better. I mean, I learned torts out of the restatement of torts. How thrilling could that be? So when I came here and was confronted with this kind of dynamic movement toward interdisciplinary studies, economics, history, psychology, philosophy, the whole stuff of a graduate program in one law school, well, I was sort of taken back. I realized I was going to have to run very fast just to keep a few paces behind. And I think looking back on it, I've been running ever since. The problem is it never stops, because every new generation of law students and every new generation of faculty just keep getting smarter and smarter. And you reach a certain age, John has made this point, you reach a certain age, and I was of a certain age at that point, where you really can't retool that well. Let's face it, you can't go back and re-educate yourself into to fit into this new environment. So you sort of wing it. And that's basically what I think I've been doing for 30 years. And it's nice to be able to say that some of that effort has paid off and some of it hasn't. I won't tell you about the parts that haven't. But after I started approaching my 70th, as I was approaching my 70th birthday, I thought, well, it's time to stop. Now, like most runners, I was advised not to just stop. You sort of slow down, cool down, right? And so I gave myself a couple of years to cool down. By the time I was only ambling along, I decided, okay, full stop. And that brings me here today. I don't mind saying I've had some reservations about that, some misgivings. Actually, quite a lot. One of them is apropos of the stopping, I remember my father used to say, I'm going to retire when they pat me on the belly with a spade. He liked that kind of folksy way of speaking, very common in Utah in those days. He wasn't a folksy fellow, but he liked that. He liked to pretend. In the event, he retired a little bit earlier than that, and in his mid-60s, and within a couple of years, he was dead. Now, I'm not a superstitious fellow, but that sort of experience does make you pause. Is there a connection there? There's another misgiving, too, and let's face it, I've had, as Earl has also nothing but pleasure being here. Excitement, challenging as it has been, it's also been a wonderful experience, socially, professionally, intellectually, in every way possible. And I'm going to miss a lot of that activity. I don't know whether I want to call it the excitement of trying to explain the rule against perpetuities, but the challenge of trying to do so. The idea of trying to get it right, you know. I mean, and as valuable as that is to try to train others, I think the real lesson here is what it forces you to tell yourself, to train yourself, because if you can't explain it to somebody else, you really don't know it. And it's sort of the thrill of knowing it that I think I'm going to miss from the classroom experience. Truth be known, I was never very good in class, but I, like a moth to the flame, I kept wanting to go back to see if I could do it better the next time. And I'm going to miss that a lot. Frankly, I'm going to miss some of the administrative involvement. For most of the period I've been here, I've been involved in committee work of one kind or another, the building committees, the appointments committees. And we complain a lot about that activity, but it really is very important. Along with alumni activities, it's really part of the glue that holds the institution and the community together. And providing it doesn't, you know, you don't get carried away with it, you don't want to do it all the time, it really sort of cements your involvement in the community. And I'll miss that part. But I do take some comfort in the fact that one of the really wonderful things about this place is that the sense of community is not defined by its youngest generation. It is truly a transgenerational. It's kind of what I would call a Burkean community. Crosses generations, living and dead to some extent. It's true I don't identify readily with William Barbee Minor, but I do remember with great fondness Emerson Spees, and in that sense, I like to think that he's still part of the community. In that sense, and in that community, I am still planning on being as active as I can possibly be, right up until, I guess, when they pat me on the belly with a spade. like Earl, I want to thank John for his leadership and friendship and for the support of all my colleagues all these last few years, 32 now. I don't want to really say goodbye to any of them or to you because I'm going to be around, as I said, as active as I can possibly be. But it's been a wonderful, wonderful run, and I thank you all for your support.
Thank you very much. If you will give me a brief moment for satire, tempted levity, I'll explain how the mural exhibit came to be. Most think it's for one of three. First, that it's a tribute to a great and great art, and others think it's just an and some think that the story of William told as an inspiration to all of you to generously to the law school. The primary reason was to address a current law school. As you know, most of the students have spent most of the time with their faces in laptop computers. It was recently observed that some of them were and further observed that on their screens actually a modicum of nudity. And so a few officious old timers, that's mature alums, held a discussion of this, and we asked ourselves, in the 1950s, did we not surface purpose? And we couldn't remember. But we do remember that we did remember that we all had these famous murals. And at 17 by 34 feet, they were quite a bit better than a mere computer. So, Eureka, we shouted. And in today's vernacular, cool. Just as in Macbeth, we come to Dunsinane, why murals, the Clark Hall murals, shall come. And such project may inspire laptops and may provoke ancient history of the law and its rich origins. Well, the truth is that the exhibit was inspired by the three items I mentioned. Plus, personally, I felt that this building needed, word echo now, an echo of Clark Hall. And the event, I mean, after all, he explained all law-related murals, and there's several others. The event project was my internet research on the artist Alan mentioned, and I found that Ted Cooper, owner of the Adams 19 studies, as the dean said, the hall, the murals, these drawings up, you'll see the exact same person somewhere in the mural. Ted is two, we acquired three, he donated all 14 of them, which are up in the special collections up there by those interested. Three of them at this time are hanging below the mural, and five former law school are photographed and hanging on the other side. Of the most interest to me is this here. It was really the concept piece with which showed plan to do and sold him on his ideas. Interesting aspects of that is there are notations on it. And, I invite you to look at those close. The personality of the artist as well as. Well, I want to thank all those who had a part in this, who had the courage to embrace a project.
On my way.
Also, Assistant Dean Bergen, patience, executed it. Ed Cooper, who is not only a gallery owner, but also a nationally known expert in 19th century American and European art. recognized appraiser of fine art at the University in Washington, D.C. Briefly on Alan Cox and... Thank you.
Thank you, John Bergen, and thank you, Dean Jeffers. This is a pretty day for the legacy of Andrews Clark and Alan Cox, and I thank his dedication and generosity in the exhibition for the new law building. These murals were the second collaboration between and Alan Cox. Is this better? The Clark Memorial UCLA was completed in 1940 and features mural designs. These are generally more dramatic compositions with muscular, like Michelangelo. Virginia murals from 31 to 30 are much more classical and heroic in nature, keeping with the themes of justice and civil rights. They shine among mural projects. Cox went on to design murals for Grant, Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, commissions for the Astor and Vanderbilt families, for murals throughout the George Masonic Memorial in Alexandria. We've seen that. It's really very impressive. Painted the rotunda frieze in the Capitol and finished the Brumidi frescoes there. Did the House and Senate corridors, Capitol murals. 70s, and one of which includes the Trail of the Moon Landing, which is a lot of fun. But of all of Alan Cox's work in these for the law library, by everyone, all the scholars who've seen Alan Cox's work as his and most thoughtful. On publicly, as I many have times, in for his imagination, dedication, and generosity. Thank you, John.
I think we're ready to cut the ribbon and
pain in his glass. So, with the mural exhibit, and hope in a very rich law school.
We'll rectify that.
Yeah.
So, thanks to you all. Thank you, John Fowler, for his leadership, and to Ted Cooper for his time. Look.